All right, guys, welcome to the show. This is Deborah Gets Red-Pilled, episode 141. Deborah's here. She is in a new studio. It's going to take a little while to get used to. How's it going over there?
It's going just fine, thank you. How's it going over there?
It is hot.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How hot?
Let's see. Maybe mid-90s, I think.
That's pretty hot for you.
So yeah, but it's going good. I'm happy. Sky's blue for once. You know, it's good. Everything's good.
It's good.
Yeah, house is hot. No AC, but we're making it. We got all the fans on. Mm-hmm. Got the windows open. There's a lot of flies in here, but that's living on a farm. So I went out and made sure all the little sheep's have water and shade. They're all good. And chickens are doing good. They're just kind of sleeping in the dirt right now. So.
Yeah. And Ricky's still sleeping in the tree.
I think so. I haven't really checked on. We got, if anybody doesn't know, we got a new rooster named Randy the Rooster.
I thought it was Ricky.
It's just kind of any male name that starts with an R is fine. So Randy, Ricky, Richard, Robert. Rupert. Yeah, Rupert, that's a good one too. I'll start using that as well. Whatever it feels like. And he's still getting beat up by some whole bunch of girls. So see how it goes. I found some dairy rams, or just one on the internet.
Uh-huh.
And I'm really trying to get your daughter to let me go get him. So
where is he?
He's in Umpqua, Washington, which is up by where your other daughter lives.
Uh-huh.
But they're a rare breed, so they're hard to find.
And how is Emily? Is she not into it?
I think she is into it, but I always feel like I need to convince her more than I do, and I just don't want her to be upset with me for trying to get into more than I can handle.
Uh-huh.
But we want to breed these little what's up, Chud?
Yo.
We want to breed these little dairy sheep. And the girl, who this super nice girl that we got them from, said that we could take them up there and do it up there. But she wants us to do like all this like blood testing. And so like by the time I go get the equipment to pull blood out of a sheep, which I don't even know how to do, send it to Oregon State University to get tested, get the results back, put my sheep in a trailer that I have to go rent from Home Depot, take them up there, drop them off, drive back home, and then rent a trailer again in a week or whatever, however long we'd leave them there, and then drive back down. It would be like more expensive than buying a ram.
Why does she want their blood tested?
Because the sheep can get diseases, and she just doesn't want it to spread to her flock. Which, because she loves them so much, so it's understandable.
I can get a ram stud kind of a deal.
Yeah, we've got that big ram, Leonard, but he is not a dairy ram. So I want to get an East Frisian lamb also. So I'll be able to breed dairy sheep and hair sheep if I have both of those guys. So that's the. That's the plan. And he's on it's only $200. So plus getting up there. He's up in Numbqua, which is by Tacoma.
Yeah. Well, we know what happens to animals in Enumclaw.
What happens up there?
That's where that animal sex ring was busted. Like 15
years ago. That's where the zoo was.
Yeah. Zoo was in Enumclaw.
Oh my God.
I didn't know that that's where it was. So I'm doing a service.
Yeah, you're saving a rescue.
You're saving a ram from God knows what.
You know, I saw that. I saw that video. Mr. Hands.
Yeah, you've mentioned it. I've never seen the real.
Don't watch it.
Deal.
No. When I used to do, I was at my first MMA gym. I was just, it was probably like 2008. And I just went in there and was like, is my audio choppy, guys. I think my internet's a little unstable.
A little choppy.
Okay, hopefully it straightens out. If it gets real bad, let me know. We'll pause. But yeah, my my trainer was like, hey, Adam, come here. He was sitting in the office. So I like went in there and like, look, he's like, hey, check this out. And he showed me the video, and it was not good. And I still, that was, you know, 15 years ago, and I still can't get it out of my head.
Yeah. I'm sure.
There must be something wrong with me because I know about that and I should.
No, everyone knew about that at the time. It was like front page news nationwide for like one day or whatever. It just hit people here in Washington a little bit more. Like my insurance in my car at the time was Mutual of Enumclaw Insurance, and Enumclaw was just all over the news for a couple days or whatever. Yeah, that was really messed up. I honestly don't remember that much. I mean, if I started looking into it, I'd be like, oh yeah, I remember all this stuff.
Yeah, but you don't want to.
It was so gross. It was so messed up. It was, you know, I put that kind of stuff on a similar level as pedophile shit. It goes beyond my ability to comprehend what someone's thinking in situations like that.
You're not on the same wavelength as, Cenk Uygur, or you think he's a proponent of that?
Who's that?
The guy from Young Turks.
Oh, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, he's made the case for it, and then he he revisited it like 10 years later, and still thinks it's okay. So, if you go back and listen, one of the Battle of the Douchebags on Abs in a Six Pack, somebody has. Has Cenk Uygur as their douchebag, and they play that clip. So, but yeah, enough of that. Okay, let's pause.
Are you back?
So guys, we got some business to get out of the way just as a formality. So executive producer for the last show was Tammy Jacques or Jakes. I'm not sure how she pronounces it, but thank you, Tammy, for your donation. Yeah. And we really appreciate it. I think I forget where she lives, but she's been a big supporter of the show for a long time.
Yeah, so, I've seen her name around in different circles and stuff. That's great.
Yeah. And yeah, guys, we've been getting some good messages, some good emails, and let us know what you think of the show. And yeah, time, talent, treasure. We are available to receive all three of those things. So, oh, great. Am I frozen again?
Oops. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. Hey, try if it starts happening again. I don't know if it's the same problem I've been dealing with, but just try shutting your camera off, like no video for a sec, and see if that straightens it at all.
Got it. Okay, so we're still recording. We're recording. Okay, sorry guys. Sorry for the technical difficulties. But yeah, so thanks to the donations, and other than that, we did a Chud, we did a show, I think, when did we do it, Deborah? On Friday.
A couple days ago.
I just released it today. We did a show with Jason Basler from the Free Thought Project. And that went pretty good. What'd you think, Deborah?
Yeah, I thought it was really good.
Yeah.
What'd y'all talk about?
We talked about the Hunter Biden iCloud leak. And yeah, just kind of stuff revolved around that.
We didn't spend too much time on that. Yeah.
Current event talk though.
Current event.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's great.
It went good. We told Deborah knows about, she learned all about Pedo Peter and you know, the whole alias.
Wait, you froze again. What did I learn about?
Pedo Pete.
What?
Oh yeah.
Oh, Pedo Pete.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was disturbing too, I bet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me shut off the video. We'll see if that works any better. Guys, our guest is here. You want to just let him in?
Sure.
Let's do it.
Here he is.
There he is.
He's connecting to audio.
Oh, snap. Deborah's here. What's going on, Earl?
Hi. What's going on, man? We're live. How's it going? Oh, shit.
Well, that was fast. Okay.
Yeah.
Getting straight into it. Hi, I'm Chud.
That's Chud X. You remember Deborah?
Do I get to see your lovely face today, Adam, or are you going to be hidden away?
I'm having a little bit of a unstable internet connection, so I'm going to give this a shot to see if it evens out, and if maybe if it's going well, I'll try it again later on. So
okay, sure.
So what's going on, dude? I just watched your new video today on Conspiracy Synergy, and I saw that you've been making the rounds, and I specifically didn't listen to any of your shows as to not influence this show.
Okay.
So what would you like to talk about today?
Anything and everything. Kind of how you guys been, what's been going on in the past year, what's your development? Because I think I spoke to you about a year ago now. It was the first time I was on your show. And I'm curious to know how's your progression been, Deborah? How's life? How is it being more on this side of things now that the world's kind of still going in this direction? I'm curious.
I'm still a work in progress. I'm getting there. I don't take anything at face value anymore. And I really did in the past. So, you know, that's different for me. You know, we Adam and I had to go through a little challenge back during, when was that, Adam? Midterms?
Well, we went through right at the end of August or early September last year was when we had our first big blowout episode. The biggest.
Yeah, it was right before 9/11 when you came up to my place. Because we talked about it in person. Like the week that first crazy blowout episode kind of happened.
Yeah. And then we had another one right around Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
So after those, Tease, I didn't know if I was going to be able to stomach going on. I felt as though it wasn't working. So I brought Chud X here on to see if he wanted to do the show with me. And then Deborah and I realized that our connection was much too strong to deny and to throw to the wayside. And we got things going back up again. So sometimes it's just her and I, and sometimes it's the three of us. And then sometimes it's just Chud X and I.
Yeah, no, that's a great anecdote.
We worked kind of through it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know what? It just goes to show that even if you have a difference of opinion, you can still be civil to one another. You can still, you know, there's benefit to the relationship. And that's a good takeaway.
Yeah. Well, we knew that before we got into a big fight. You know, that's kind of that's what the whole show's about.
The overall arch with all of that, though, I would hope that our listeners could hear how even though things can get hairy at times, you always come out on the other side and can continue the conversation. It doesn't have to be a flip the game board and get out completely and never talk to someone again just because things got hairy.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And I also think in that time too, you guys had two episodes with Buck Johnson, one on here, and then one on his show, A Counterflow with Buck Johnson. And I think that you guys really, really worked through a lot of stuff in that time. And it was, as you know, I'm a contributor now too, but just as a listener as well, it was a really, really good period of time to understand this whole concept that you came up with, Adam, of this podcast and why it's so great and why there are such benefits to talking to people from across the aisle.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. And I think, you know, Deborah and I are pretty close now. And I think the show is beneficial for Deborah as well, because I think sometimes she feels isolated in her life too. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's hard being the only red pillar in a blue-pilled society.
Yeah, but it's a good... I think you I think you handle it well, and I don't blame you for keeping your mouth shut most of the time. So
well, can you give me some sense of, do you feel that environment shifting, not necessarily the full spectrum of the color, but maybe ending up a little bit more purple somewhere in between? Like, are people kind of their load bar slider of starting to take it less on face value is making its way further over? Are you kind of finding that?
Well, I have a little bit actually from different corners than I would have expected. I have my Deborah Gets Red Pilled t-shirt, and I wear it when I work out at the gym sometimes. And it always gets, because there's always different people in there, and people are always asking, Deborah, is that you? Deborah, is that, what does that mean? And so I've been a little more open about it, and I'm just telling people, and if they care to listen, great. If they don't, you know, that's fine too. But when the conversation happens, people are, we're getting, you know, I'm hearing more frustration with our government, with our media, and I think I don't know.
In your little bubble.
Yeah, I think.
In my little bubble, yeah.
I think it's hard for me to believe that there aren't people in your bubble and every other, like, wherever they are. People have to be more open to the red pill today than they were yesterday, and they were a year ago, and they were 5 years ago. Like, it's exponentially getting more and more reasonable to accept that red pill and be like, oh yeah, I think there's something afoot here.
Yeah. Well, when you put, you know, two and two together, then, and it's been shoved in people's faces, you know, all this back and forth about COVID and back and forth about, you know, just our political state of chaos. Mm-hmm. So, I told this to Adam the other day, that I saw a headline somewhere that more than 50% of the U.S. population is no longer claiming Democrat or Republican as their party.
That's what I'm talking about right there. Like, that's, I mean, I'm not saying that everybody's like, you know, taking a red pill and talking about flat earth or, you know, like going real extreme in things, but they just have to be like, yeah, things aren't the way that they're being painted to me. Mm-hmm. I just can't handle this media narrative where they're saying one thing, but something else is happening in front of my eyes. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So Tease, where do we go?
Tease, last time we talked to you, you were dressing up in a bunny costume and handing out scrolls on the bus to people. What's up now?
So I've still do stuff like that. I did in front of a 12-foot banner, sitting in the rabbit costume again on a red beanbag chair, handing those out to people. And I've done that, and I've had them in art shows, the Truth Art Show in Colorado. They're available there, and so it's just continuing to try and get information out to people who otherwise are just completely stranded within the echo chambers of the media environment that has been created to suffocate them with lies, which is basically Plato's cave. And so if you're trying to put your own version of that shadow puppet, say a little rabbit jumping in on the wall, they're like, get that rabbit out of here, I'm trying to watch that reality that I enjoy so much. But if you do playful little reminders like that, and you try and keep it upbeat and compassionate, then with a little bit of patience and the continuation of their frustration, hopefully we'll be able to find our way out of the maze and be able to get some of those people who otherwise would have been lost for all of their days. So it's a long road. It's this is designed to be a war of attrition from the perspective of the psychopathic ruling class and how they've gone about things for so long, more or less operating with impunity. But we're at a very unique time period wherein we have not only the technology, but the circumstance thrust upon us that warrants its use beyond how we have, let's say up to this point, almost embraced the internet as a canvas and platform of abuse, you know, because we're so used to going online and feeling like crap. And more that we do that, we're staring into these black mirrors that are bones, it's like we're kind of taking that step back. And it isn't necessarily that we can completely get rid of it, because that's not going to happen. This thing isn't going to go away. It's more that we need to elevate ourselves. And I think that that's kind of spreading around, and it's making its way around. And that's sort of why I was asking the question of, do you find that your environment, Deborah, in more of like that blue-pilled kind of arena, is starting to see that color hue just a little bit with those unspoken emotional receptivity? And that's my felt sense of things as well. So it's just trying to take that momentum and keep it going and remind everyone that it doesn't happen in an instant. And it very much is something that takes a very long time to be able to get people up to the emotional wherewithal of grappling with the betrayal of what has happened. So that's my thing.
And how do you grapple with it?
Oh, I'm massively depressed all the time, personally. But there's a great quote, which is, I think it's Nietzsche, and it's not verbatim, so I don't remember exactly what it is, but he's saying that every man who has ever realized his personal heaven has found the strength to do so in the midst of his personal hell. Mm-hmm. And that's one of those things. It's like, it's not going to be on your side when it's a fight for your life. It's not going to be giving you those big rewards. It's going to be giving you those tiny little reminders. And that's kind of like how that seed slowly comes to see the light, and how we need to almost remind ourselves that it doesn't happen all at once. And so for me, I'm a very patient and impatient person at the exact same time, because these are people having their lives ruined. It's excruciating. It's utterly, it's so horrific that it's difficult to face without feeling as if you're just plunged under, but then you have to find the courage to be able to surface again and dive back down. And so it's time, man. It's just a passage of time. Most of all, it's trying to grapple with that, because it's not going to go away. It's going to get worse. And how do you keep a smile on your face in the middle of that? It's leading by example. And that's having conversations like this and starting podcasts like this. And it's wearing shirts when you go to the gym, and it's having nice revitalizing little conversations so that people get those visual representations to remind them that, hey, there is a little cute rabbit hopping onto Plato's cave.
So
that's great. It's like,
go ahead, Chuck.
I'll go ahead. Go ahead. Ed.
Okay. So you're in Calgary or Edmonton, somewhere around there, right?
Edmonton, but they're Edmonton, man, it's a nightmare. Wow, this place is like, there's a special kind of brainwashed. It's like 30% or something of people still voluntarily wear masks everywhere outside by themselves. And it's just like driving by themselves. And I'm like, okay, this is scary. But yeah, that's where I'm
at. That's so crazy to me, because I listen to the guys from Grimerica, and they're in, are they in the same?
No, okay. So the way that works is like, we're like 4 hours north of Calgary. And Calgary,
well, you guys they were way up north.
Yeah. So, but Calgary is like, they got hit economically much harder than Edmonton did, like way harder. And because of that, it woke a lot more people up. And so they take the protesting much more seriously. They take everything that's going on much more seriously. Edmonton, everyone's sort of just in a daze of posturing as if they know what's going on. Where in Calgary, it's like, they don't have the luxury to afford posing. You either know, or you're someone who is knowingly choosing not to, and that creates an environment of animosity. So in Edmonton, it's more like, I describe it as pathologically polite. Everyone prioritizes being polite over having the necessary conversation. So it's like, they're different places, even though it's like the same place, they're because of the economic situation, they're different places.
It strikes me as strange that it's so compliant there, because isn't like that the oil fields and kind of the big like the, yeah, Montana or the Texas or whatever, yeah, of Canada?
So insofar as the cultural threads that you would pick up on, and like the common conversation, and like the blue collar worker kind of stuff, that's like, I've done industrial labor. It's one of those things where it's just like, it's sort of the norm around here, and that's all true. But then you got to get into like the Canadian culture, in essence, just being like the almost like backwash of the colonialist like preoccupation, and how like during 1776, when America was going through its revolution, they were trying to send people up north in order to get Canada to jump on board, but they wouldn't do it. And if you look into the way in which like the roads kind of like secret society infrastructure had infiltrated and maintained, in essence, dominion within the Canadian realm, it makes perfect sense that we're in essence still just like the lingering echo chamber of colonialism. We still have the queen on our money. Like it's the Pope's visiting right now to apologize for like what happened with the residential schools.
Yeah.
So, but it's like, we're very much, and that's why I say pathologically polite, It's like, look at like the stiff upper lip mentality of the British, like that whole, oh, no, no, it's like you just don't show your pain. Don't allow that kind of thing to be public. But I made a feature film a while ago called Hold Me, and it's about a woman whose job it is to hold and console people who are being voluntarily euthanized. And it's the idea of the weight that people are in a caregiving capacity take upon themselves in order to do what they do. And I, in the process of making that film, I had a conversation with a gentleman named Nico Sekopet, who works for Dying with Dignity Canada, which is in essence trying to have the necessary conversations so that people who are very much at the end of life don't have to go through prolonged torture. But that's sort of an aside to the point that he made, which is the notion of how we deal with our grief as a society. And his fundamental underlying contention is this: grief is meant to be shared. It is meant to be something that we live together, that we have the responsibility to face together. And the more in which we shirk that, avoid that, or close our mouths in the face of it, the more it broods within us until it explodes amongst us. And so that's what's going on. We've got a lot of people here who are just pissed off all the time. They're not handling it very well, but they still aren't at the point where they can verbalize it or put it out there and speak about it with confidence. So it's that whole idea of what it is to be in this much grief, this much depression, this much pain, and still find it in ourselves to be able to reach for better days. And that's like, that's kind of like the Canadian cultural zeitgeist of what's going on right now. And the notion of how, as Western societies derived from like British kind of like cultural influences long ago, we've been built up in this way, not to embrace one another as people, not to have the courage to go out there and talk about the pain we're in. And it's killing us, quite literally.
Do you think that's true all across Canada? Or like, I'm not sure how big Edmonton, that's where you said you are?
Yeah, it's about a million people.
Yeah, okay. So it's a heavily populated area.
It's the northernmost metropolis. And so far as whether it's the true across all Canada, it's hugely regionally specific. And we have a tendency to do this as people. We can talk about the United States, but if you've, like, I've traveled all over the United States, there are so many different countries inside of that country.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's the same thing here. It's like you got those little kind of burps, but like, insofar as like the revolutionary spirit, America is so much farther along than Canada is. Uh-huh. So it's like, we're still lagging, generally speaking.
Because I live real close to Vancouver in Washington State. And a lot of people around here have a real defined idea of what Canadians are like, in air quotes, Canadians.
Yeah.
But I often remind them that, no, you're talking about people from Vancouver. Canucks, I think, would be a lot of Canadians who aren't from Vancouver, who are from kind of like the boonies of Canada, who all seem like really normal people, like really, you know, like the same as down here. I mean, if you only go to Seattle, Portland, New York City, LA, you know, like the big cities, and you say, I know what America's like, I would say, oh, excuse me, no, you don't. You know, you know what big city culture is like in certain parts of America. And I've for a long time, I've had a picture in my head that, you know, say, and maybe this from city to city, large area to large area in Canada, maybe there's some major similarities, but I would imagine that there's a whole lot of people dotted around in between who are very different.
Oh yeah, no, that's what the cultural uprising of the whole trucker convoy thing was. It was based around those rural communities. And if you look at like Lockstep, so taking it from the Rockefellers and how they've wargamed this, they anticipate that there will be the cultural osmosis internally within the cities, which is increasingly going to be co-opted by transhumanism. And then simultaneously, there's the spillover that they regard as the fringe, which exists off kind of just doing their own thing. And so it's been wargamed and strategized in that way, partially because it already exists that way, but also because they're trying to make it more like that, because then we can very easily be turned against one another and polarized even though we're neighbors. So it's like your basic description. Yeah, that is foundationally how it works. And it's the same in the US. And it's like, how do we come together now to be able to talk to each other when we're this polarized and we don't have stories that have been told to us that are representative of the reality? You know, it's like, how do we come together? Just be like, no, we're just people, man. Be like, him, her, they, there, whatever. You're a human being. I love you. Let's leave it at that. You know?
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah, it's a different, I live in a different country than 40 miles down the road. You know, it's like vastly different. Yeah, I talked about it. I went on a show called America Unplugged the other day, but we went to the county fair on Friday, and it was like the most uplifting, like, white pill ever. It was so fun, and it was just America. It was just normal America. Like, we watched the little kids with their 4-H kids, like, showing their pigs, like these little 6-year-old girls, like, moving pigs around. It was really cute. And then we got to ride on the rides, and we went to the rodeo afterwards. It was a really, really good time, and it really, really gave me some hope. So if you guys are feeling real down and out, maybe find the closest rural community to you and go to the county fair. It's probably coming up soon. So I'd say do something like that.
That's good advice. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. We got one coming up here soon. Yeah. I'm looking forward to it.
Is there a rodeo?
Just a gay rodeo.
Oh, no. Really?
No. But we're probably going to go for the demolition derby instead of the rodeo.
Oh, cool. Yeah. We didn't have a demolition derby, but yeah, it was really good. I ate some corn dogs, had a milkshake, you know, broke some rules for myself, but it was definitely worth it. So,
you had a turkey leg?
No, they didn't have any turkey legs.
It wasn't the county fair.
It wasn't the Renaissance fair, dude.
What about a funnel cake?
I didn't see, you know, like they have, it's rural, but they had kind of some like upscale food truck section. Like they have the corn dog stand and like the cotton candy that is with the traveling carnies, you know. It's like their stand and their stuff. And then there was like a separate corn dog food truck there. And I went and got that one instead of the one that was made by like the toothless tweaker guy. So
I bet that was really, really delicious.
Yeah. But it was cool. And but yeah, so your new installation of Conspiracy Synergy just dropped, and it's pretty good, man. And you want to get into your series with us and what the new one's about and what the past ones have done as well?
Yeah, so my whole deal is that I'm an artist, and I've been studying conspiracy and corruption and controversy for a long time, 15 years going through it, initially with 9/11 truth and being an activist in that regard, and taking an approximate, let's say, a similar emotional approach to what the Madres did during the Dirty War in order to bring attention to their disappeared friends and family. So what I would do is I'd wear an American flag as a blindfold and a shirt that says 9/11 is an inside job. And I'd stand at ground zero on September 11th for about 6 to 8 hours by myself, holding out DVDs or cards for people to take as they passed me. And that's something where, to give you an example of how successful individual protests can be, utilizing art that accurately captures the theme of what you're trying to do, I got rid of 100 DVDs in less than 5 minutes, and everyone thanked me along the way. Now that's on September 11th at ground zero from the people who work in the stock market. So that can tell you that a lot of the time people are afraid, and that's the thing that keeps them from venturing into these sort of territories, feeling as if they're alone. And at the same time, we have this idea of bringing people together in large groups and like chanting things or going on marches. And then that's the idea of what brings about change, but it doesn't actually change that much. It can kind of bring attention to something, but it's what we do with that afterward that brings about the change. So much of what we're dealing with right now is emotional, and it's people not necessarily knowing the first steps to take in order to be able to get on the right track that we need to go as people who care about each other. So I created the show Conspiracy Synergy, which is about trying to capture the energy of this moment as we're transitioning into a revolution, not a violent one, a very positive, healthy, people getting along better, making better systems that would work better for everyone. That's what a revolution is. And the internet is an extraordinarily interesting cultural bubble because it's everything happening all at once. So I wanted to make a show that felt like all the stuff on the internet all pulled together in a very happy, upbeat way to lead people the appropriate direction in order to facilitate our global revolution in response to the intended Great Reset. And my most recent episode is called Normie Outreach Episode, and it's the most carefully maneuvered attempt that I have thus far made in order to speak of very troubling themes without making people feel very troubled when hearing about them. And that's the whole kind of like spirit of my show in order to try and lift other people's spirits up. And I'm going to continue to go with that. It's designed to be about 12 episodes. It's going to take me another 2 to 3 years to finish that just because of how labor intensive it is and all the research and stuff. But it is the plan to save the world, the emotional thrust for the revolution that we need, picking up off of all of the work that everyone else is doing, which is why you guys are one of the podcasts that are featured in the fourth episode for others to recommend to check out, because these are a bunch of different threads that all cumulatively come together. And if you're able to package that into one place and make it really entertaining for people, well, then you're able to break through to those who you thought you'd never be able to reach. And so that's what I'm all about.
Yeah. What are some of the themes that you think are basic outreach, some of the topics that you can get into with people who are, you know, Deborah's friends?
That's one of those things where it's hugely individually specific, like, and it's laden with a lot of emotional landmines from the past. It's very difficult to talk to people about Vietnam. It's very difficult to talk about a lot of those major events that were orchestrated in order to bring about lifelong trauma that's never really revisited. I remember when I was on Corbett like a decade or more ago talking about the short film, The Blindfold, that you guys have seen. And towards the end of the interview, I was talking about how a big part of the reason that people don't deal with this stuff is because it's like, it's traumatizing all over again. It's like if you go through razor wire and it sinks in, it's like it all, you almost have to make the wound worse to get it out. And that's, it's designed to be like that. So it's very individually specific. It's so individually specific. There are those large events that are organized to traumatize us all, but then there's also the family encounter that a particular individual had that makes them see it a different way. And so it's really just talking to the person and figuring out who they are, what they have been through, what they're struggling with, what they can't look at. And if you're there trying to force them to look at it, then they're going to remember that and they're going to hate the next person who tries to come their way and talk sense to them. So much of what we need to do right now is really just listen to each other as people and understand the sensitivity and the pain and still find the courage to be able to revisit those very, very dark themes again, you know? So it's one of those things where it's like, I wish I had an ABCD kind of approach to this whole thing, but it's a more complicated equation.
Yeah. Well, your podcast seemed, I was watching it earlier, and it's very intimidating. It's friendly and welcoming and.
That's exactly it. Because like, so the next one I'm doing is step-by-step visual representations of how to facilitate the emergence of a real world revolution. You know what the number one first step that you take in a global revolution is? Make new friends.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's amazing. Cause yeah. Chud and I met on, you know, talking, we went on the same Zoom chat with Monica Perez, you know, and one of her like patron parties or whatever. And we met there, you know, now we know each other in real life and have a podcast together. And I know people all over the country from the computer, but not, you know, but I'm pretty sure I could get along with people in real life as well.
And that's what me, Adam and my wife and I just did a podcast recently where we talked about, you know, in 2020, as all of this pandemic BS came to, like all we all realized that we needed to reach out and find our people. Like I've been living in the, you know, libertarian like liberty movement kind of world since 2008. And I've known people here and there. And, you know, it's not that I haven't known people who were like-minded to me, but in 2020, as everybody started isolating themselves, I realized that if I'm going to talk to anyone, I need to find people who like really align with what I think, you know, not just a little bit, not just, oh yeah, we all know that the housing crash was avoidable and that the way we solved it was wrong. You know, like that's like, I don't know, that doesn't really get to the core of what my beliefs are and what is really, really, really important to me. But once we started having to deal with people being afraid of the air, you know, then we started kind of getting into like more of the nitty gritty and people started dividing up more. And that's not something that I want, but out of that, I had to start finding the people that I aligned with, like on instead of one level, like 10 levels. Yeah. And my life has gotten better since the pandemic because of that. You know, I'm not glad about the pandemic for that reason by any means. I wish I'd realized this before, but that's what pushed me. And it seemed like Adam from our conversation felt the same way too. You know, it's like we started realizing that we need better friends.
Yeah, that's good. And I think as we do that more and more and we find those revitalizing kind of communities and those like, just because like, so the rallies that I go to, I describe it, this is a sane environment to regain your energy in so that you go back into the world and then facilitate the change there. And it's like, just that feeling of revitalization and being reinvigorated by those positive steps forward, that situates you so that as things get worse for everyone else who hasn't been able to do that, you're able to lead by example.
Mm-hmm.
Cause that's where we're at increasingly more moving forward. Is like, this is not about explaining it to people who ridicule you and will not listen to you. That's the job I've taken on and it sucks. Trust me, I don't recommend it. But like, insofar as what it is to go out there, it's leading by example. And each of us is a leader in our own right. Each of us is able to do something better. And that doesn't make us better than other people. It makes us better able to help other people. And so that's what we're doing. We're getting that strength to be able to revitalize because it is a war of attrition. And we're going to be able to help lead by example. People can make it through it, you know?
Oh, it's so true. I realize more and more all the time that is the way forward because, you know, like again, 2020, sorry, I don't mean to keep bringing it up, but you know, it had a big impact on us all. Yeah. I thought that one of the most important things I was doing in 2020, especially like before I met Adam and I was really reaching out and finding people, was going into a store without a mask and being the best person in that store, you know, being the only person who helps an old lady pick something up when she drops it because everyone else is afraid to get within 6 feet. And then here's this one guy who's a crazy guy who's not wearing a mask. And he's not only picking something up for people, but smiling. And I'm smiling at the cashier, which I didn't really do before 2020 because, you know, it was just a mundane thing of going to a store or whatever. But now I had to like kind of put on this armor to be able to get through this because everyone's, you know, noticing me as the one guy without a mask. And I had to be, you know, I put my best face forward. And then I would realize that as I got to a cashier, this is the first face they've seen, if not all day, in hours. And I'm not grumpy. And I'm there and I ask them how their day is going. And I want to know, you know, I'm being personal with them. And all of a sudden I could see that I was brightening these people's days up. And that's the idea of leading by example, if I'm understanding right.
Oh yeah, no, it's both that in the sense of positive felt sense of how we rejuvenate one another as people, but so too is to be creative, because so much of the way society is built right now is like Lego block iterations of what we see on TV telling us who we're supposed to be or what we're supposed to strive for. But what if your purpose in life is to do something that no one's ever done before? That's leading. And then you do that in a way in which you're not demeaning the other people who are following you. Instead, you're emboldening them and helping them achieve their better self too. And so kind of like what you're speaking about with how important and powerful a smile can be. It's like, I was actually on Monica Perez's show like a couple of weeks ago. And the example that I gave on that, and I think it's actually a succinct encapsulation of what we just experienced in the most profound level of what we all went through with this pandemic, which has nothing to do with sickness. It has nothing to do with health. It has nothing to do with any of that. It has to do with our connection as people. And it's built around the premise of, imagine if you got a bunch of stupid villains together in like an evil lair or whatever. And they're like, all right, what if we take away everybody's smile? And that's literally what happened. They took away everybody's smile, quite literally, and make everyone go around and they're hiding their smile from that. In and of itself is like the most evil thing you can do. Yeah. And so all the rest of it is kind of just like window dressing for that kind of brutal like behavior and treatment that was done to people. So leading by example, it can be as simple as a smile, or it can be as profound as realizing something and creating something that no one's ever seen before.
How do you,
beautiful man.
How do you, so something that I'm probably going to struggle with for the rest of my life because of the way the world is now is forgiveness and being able to, you know, interact with people that I've written off because of all this. You know, there's like like what Chudex just said about having people that you have 10 things in common with. There was people that I used to think were on my team, and then they did like one thing, and it's just like, I can't, you know, you're pretty good on everything else, but I can't let you get away with that one. You know, I can give examples, but I won't. But what's the road to redemption on that one?
So that's one of the things I struggle with most. There's a great Cornel West quote, which is that accountability precedes forgiveness every time, which I find very interesting, because it's the idea that if you're just automatically forgiving people, they can almost see that as like a liability or a vulnerability, and then take advantage of you over and over again, or not ultimately learn their lesson. So what we want to strive for ideally is accountability. That can become very emotionally burdensome to ourselves and to other people if we champion ourselves as if we're somehow an arbiter or an ambassador on behalf of the law. So it's really difficult for us to let of those pains, they continue to pain us. You know, not like this is something that's going away. It's still happening all around us. So it's like, it's not necessarily that I have like the best answer for it. The reality is that it is, and I'm not Christian, but it's the stuff that Jesus was talking about. It is about turning the other cheek. And the whole idea of that is to even out the scars. People are going to slap you away. They're going to be mean to you. They're going to be cruel to you. And the greatest evolution of your higher self that you can possibly reach is letting go of those baggage that are dragging you down and that are making it so that you aren't able to meet the people that you need to meet, be the person that you need to be in order to make those connections. And so it's like forgiveness. It's like, there's another kind of insight from the Buddhist perspective, which is that holding on to anger is like holding on to a hot coal with the intention of throwing it at someone else. It's you that gets burned.
Yeah.
And that's true. But I like to think of it as an additional step to that, because anger can be a gift. Anger can be a profoundly important force because it allows you to know that something is unfair. So it's transmuting the anger. Take that thing that you cannot forgive and find some way to create steps that bring about something different from it. Maybe you can't do it all in one. Maybe you need to do it in a sequence of things that allows you to overcome, but find whatever transmutational process you can do. And so to give an example, like the fire of a coal, put that coal under a pot, fill that pot with water, and then delicately put an egg in it, and you have a soft boiled egg. So you're able to take the thing that would have destroyed you and make a nice healthy breakfast instead. So it's like, take that metaphor for whatever it is that it applies to your life, be creative with it, and maybe you won't feel the same way about it.
Yeah. I had my own experience with this a number of years ago. I was holding on to anger. It was a personal thing. It wasn't a, you know, situation. I was mad at an individual, and carried that resentment for a long time, and literally woke up one morning, you know, nobody ever told me, you know, this is going to wear off or anything like that, but literally woke up one morning and realized this is a choice that you have made to hold on to this anger and resentment. And you don't have to. You can just let it go. And it made a really big difference in my life. Just letting it go.
Yeah, it's really important.
It is.
Yeah.
Very difficult. So kudos to you.
Yeah, that's that's what the eighth and ninth step in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. It's, you know, you make a list of every single person that you've, you know, ever harmed. And then you go and you for the ninth step, you go and you make amends to the ones that's not going to, you know, hurt them worse or like put yourself in danger, you know. And even like what you'll find is that the people that you have resentments against show up on that list. And even if, you know, you're not wholeheartedly sorry when you make amends to people, it's like a huge, most of the time, a huge weight lifted off your chest. And it's, yeah, it's just keeping your side of the street clean and being the bigger person. And then that makes it so people don't get to live rent free in your head, you know. And some people, you know, you have a justifiable anger towards, and then some people it's, you know, it's just a disagreement or like a misunderstanding most of the time. And people don't, like, if you think you did something terrible to somebody and you go and you talk to them about it, they're like, what, I don't even remember that. I don't know what you're talking about. Or like, oh, we were all fucked up, you know, like, well, just, it's not a big deal, you know? So.
But owning it like that also is, you know, people are grateful that you just recognize, yes, I did this and it was not cool. And I'm sorry I did it, you know?
Yeah.
In whatever form you can say that, it, it's good for you. It's good for them. Everybody wins.
Yeah. So you talked earlier about a little bit of, you know, trauma that people have gone through that have shaped the way that people aren't willing to face the truth or another perspective. Deborah is 69 years old. Correct, Deborah? Am I right correct. This time? Okay.
Yes, you are.
You look fantastic.
You can call me 80. God, thanks.
So she is right in the middle of the generation that we refer to as boomers, who I villainize quite frequently on the show, and I probably shouldn't do it as much. But do you see, I mean, I can't, like, Deborah's an amazing anomaly. I can't talk to my parents like I do to her. Do you see that generation as being victims of traumatization more than others? I think we're all, you seem like you're probably in your mid 30s or so. I'm early 40s. Chugs.
No, I'm mid 30s. Yeah. Late 30s, I guess. But
yeah, so we're all the same.
Yeah.
And Deborah's old.
No, we're all the same. And that's one of those things. It's like, we get those generational blips that give us a dispositional leaning one way or another. What the past generations went through, be it directly themselves or as a byproduct of their parents from either Vietnam or the first or the second World War, that is surreal. You can look at the literature for our psychological state of being, and we're about 5% conscious self and 95% unconscious or subconscious. And if you think of the Machiavellian pragmatic application of torture techniques in order to bring about mass PTSD and how carefully you're able to engineer that in large warlike events that then facilitate microcosm emergences that reflect those warlike events. So I can give you an anecdote from my own life. I remember one time when I was younger, I was in Virginia visiting an uncle of mine. And we were just playing in the lake together, just like having fun or whatever. And he was a Vietnam vet. Like he was previously like head of VMI school. He was responsible for like an aircraft carrier. So he's like fairly high up there, dude. And he'd been an helicopter pilot in Vietnam. And I remember that I was just playing around and everything was cool. And then he kind of just like got this look on his face. And he's like, hey, that's enough for now. And he like turned around and he like started walking out of the water. And I'm just like a kid. So I'm just like, splashed him one more time. And he turned around really viciously and he grabbed my head and he shoved it underwater and he held it underwater. It wasn't just to make a point to me. He held it down until I was like sputtering for breath. And he was making the point clear to me that he could murder me if he wanted to. And then I kind of sprung up from the water and I looked around and like, he let me go and he lurched back up to the patio and he fell into a chair and he kind of like did this with his hand and like slapped it across his face. And he looked around and I'm looking at him like, what just happened? I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't deserve that. What was that? And he kind of like muttered, it's like, do you want to go for ice cream or something? And I could tell from him saying that he was very sorry. But whatever had happened was something like I did not understand. So fast forward to about like 18 or something years old, graduating out of high school. And I'm going across the country to visit family. And I'm visiting him again. And I'm like, all right, I know you're a big military dude. Movie Black Hawk Down came out. Let's watch that together. And so we watch a movie together and that's fine. We don't talk during the whole thing. And at the end of it, and what he says is absolutely unrelated to anything that happens in that movie. But what he says is this: when you see a friend of yours skinned alive and then stuck on a stick and paraded around in front of you, it doesn't scare you, it provokes you. I cannot put into words the horrors of what the people who went through the Second World War suppressed within themselves and the various different ways in which that came to erupt on their families. And when you understand the methodological refinement of torturing the human being, this is not incidental, it is not accidental, is it a calculative byproduct of facilitating the constant, relentless saturation of war within us as people? They habitually entrain us to become our own oppressors, our own abusers, and then we are so saturated that an environment that we would almost choose death over revisiting the thing that made us feel that bad. And so that's what happened to everyone that grew up before we did. And the idea of us as kids coming out there just trying to like, hey, here's a little splash of something. What's that going to trigger in them? Mm-hmm. You know? And so that's the reality of it. That's one of those like really heartbreaking things where we don't talk about the trauma, but that's like I said before, it's our responsibility to talk about it more and more.
Yeah. They had JFK as well in there too. So they had, what are the big ones for the boomers? JFK, Vietnam War.
And then Bobby getting shot. And it's just like, is there no hope? What is going on? It's just like, it never stops. And that's the neocon kind of like continuation of the CIA being founded after disbanding the OSS in order to bring about the continuation of the Second World War. First World War never stopped. It was a 20-year rearmament to facilitate the emergence of the Second World War, which was never stopped. It became Project Gladio. Nazis didn't lose. They won the war. They were integrated into the culture. The entire situation that we're in is the continuation of the Second World War. Nothing that has happened in that time span has been separate from that. So it's just like, man, we're coming out of a hell of a doozy of what has been done to us as people. It's surreal.
Yeah. It's wild to think how many people, everyone we know has like issues with like how screwed up people are with their families, you know? And it's like, it's just so, even if there wasn't like physical abuse, it's just everybody's got a little bit of that, you know, and it's.
Well, everybody's got family issues. And, you know, like you say right there, like not all of it's like physical abuse. And then that even unto itself makes that abuse like even or not that makes that those difficult things even harder to talk about because like, well, I don't come from a bad family. I wasn't like molested or beaten as a kid. So therefore I need to shut the fuck up about my bad family dynamics. You know what I mean? Like,
Yeah.
No, that's one of those things that we have a tendency to do. We marginalize either our pain or that of someone else because someone else went through things a lot worse. And that's true. I mean, like, oh my God, like some of the horrific things that people go through, it's just absolutely mind-boggling. But it's like, I don't know about you, but for me, the most painful things in my entire life aren't physical. They're things that have been said, or they're ways that I've been made to feel, or they're environments that I found myself in. It's the gradual extinguishing of my ability to feel as if I have anyone else that I can talk to. It's the solitary confinement that murders you most. So, you know, maybe if you're growing up in an environment where you're getting beaten, but you're still able to occasionally experience human connection, that could feasibly be a more, you know, quote unquote, healthy environment to grow up in than something that makes you feel alone every single second of every single day all the time. And so it's like, we got to remember that there are a lot of different ways that abuse can come to manifest and then spill out over onto other people. And we also have each of our kind of like vulnerabilities. Like I grew up the fat kid. So it's one of those things where it's like that's forever makes me insecure about the way that I look forever. It's just how it goes. And so it's like those tiny little things bring about lifelong battles. And yeah, we can marginalize what we've been through and what other people have been through, but it's really, really difficult. And so it's going to be interesting that hopefully we'll find a way to be more compassionate in a way in which we can hear other people's pain without feeling the need to stamp it out either in them or within ourselves, you know, to kind of just share in it and appreciate it for what it is.
Yeah. You know, like on the marginalizing of things, I used to have I still have a chronic illness that used to cause constant, really bad pain. And people who knew me through that time, you know, like really very few people knew like the level of physical pain I was in all the time. And this is physical, but I think this could apply to other forms of difficulty and abuse. I used to say, you know, like people would say to me like, oh, I stubbed my toe. It's the worst. And then they'd recognize what I was going through and they'd be like, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say that. And I started having this saying that I would say, yeah, but it's all relative to where you're at. Like, I think that everyone's worst pain and their physical pain is the worst thing they've ever felt when it's the worst thing they've ever felt. And it's not fair to compare it to someone who's got a different type of pain. But yeah, sure, maybe if we had some scale to judge what pain is, you know, the guy with a broken leg is worse than the guy with the broken toe, and the guy with the broken toe is worse than the guy with the stubbed toe, you know, or something like that. But all three of those people are in excruciating pain in a moment, you know, and I really felt that we need to be able to, I as someone who was in pain needed to be able to recognize other people's pain, even if it was lesser than my pain. And I that was a difficult thing for me. I mean, that was because I struggled with it for 25 years. So it was like I had time to think about it and really, really understand it. I think that can transfer into emotional things and other types of trauma and things like that. Your trauma in your moment, when it's the worst, your depression, your trauma, whatever it is you're going through, if it's the worst thing you've ever gone through, it's the worst thing you've ever gone through. And it's not fair to say, oh, really? You were just hit by your dad? I was raped by my dad. Don't tell me that's worse than what I've got, you know, or anything like that. And I think that if everyone could recognize that, it would really help understanding. That's for sure.
That's a great, great example. And that's exactly what I'm referring to. Exactly the story that you told, that's that mentality that you came to, that you were able to think about for a long time. That's exactly what we want to be able to reach as people. It's exactly that.
Deborah, do you have any questions?
Not at the moment, I don't.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're the question maestro, bro. It's on you.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess what I'd like to get into, I'm not a huge fan of traditional.
Oh, and you froze even with your camera off.
Okay, I'm frozen.
He's kind of there still. No, you're back now.
You're back.
Okay, so I'm not a huge fan of traditional activism, like, you know, just run of the mill protesting, going out in public and like yelling at the other side. What do you think is the best way to, if somebody wants to get active, to jump into it? I don't know. What do you think?
Whatever they're best at. And yeah, this is one, kind of like when I talked to you guys before, it's like I brought up the things like, hey, Deborah, do you think that you have the power to go out there and learn all this stuff and then explain it like meticulously and all this kind of stuff? And she's like, no, man. And I'm like, okay, well, do you have the power to be a nice person who loves other people? She's like, yeah, I can do that. And it's like, okay, go with that, lead with that. And it's like, it's that kind of thing. It's like the thing that you're good at or the things that you're best at is needed by someone somewhere, and use that to your advantage. If you're really good at making cookies, right? I don't know, something on a cookie that can brighten someone's day and also maybe plant a seed of awakening for a brighter future, that kind of thing. So it's one of those very individually specific things. Like, it's so granular the way that this actually works. Like, if we could pull back and look at it, it's like those tiny little moments of influence can bring about profound movements of change. And so it's just like appreciating that it takes time, and then it's those little things that make all the difference in the world. And you can make that difference in someone else's life. And even just you thinking right now, be like, maybe I could just do that little thing and it would mean the world to them. And then that would change the world in 10 or 20 or 30 years. And the answer is it does. We just don't necessarily see it directly.
Yeah. Do you think that traditional activism still works or ever works?
Oh, no. It's broken by design. It's broken by design. So you can look at examples of it working, like Gandhi going to the sea in order to get salt so that he could defy the British imperial or like colonialist kind of like, you have to buy salt from them or they're not allowed to create salt. Or it's like them making their own clothes, you know? So it's like, that's traditional, but it's also creative. So it's things like mass marches don't really do anything other than give you a tiny blip of feeling as if you've been a part of something, or as if you've accomplished something, when the problem's still there, you just walk around in circles for a while. So I have big issues with it as well, but you can do things with that at times that take it to the next level, which is it is your moral obligation not to follow unjust laws. Now, that said, we're in a really bad predicament as people because we're basically living in kind of like prison-like societies as a byproduct of our governments being built to act as our slave masters, in essence. And so to fully not cooperate at this current juncture will almost invariably see you thrown in jail almost immediately. So it becomes one of those pragmatic sort of pivoting of what is most important at this moment so that I can continue to enact and facilitate change while at the same time not necessarily going so hardcore that I just find myself locked up in chains, you know? So it's one of those things where it's like, it's a strategic maneuvering of a creative and playful realm that in the way in which we've historically done things has just been like the same thing over and over again. You hold a picket sign, you walk in circles, you can do sit-ins, you can do like, you try and enact change internally within the machine, but that's designed to defeat you. So it's like, I share your frustrations. And that's why like the next episode I'm doing, it's all built around, okay, give people the visual representations to understand that the social connections we make, the positive communities that we funnel our energy into are leading by example and are understanding how these systems are designed to subvert us. That's the future of revolution. It's how well we can live as people and how well we can support the other people around us. Our very existence becomes the movement. We don't need to go out and march anymore because everybody already knows because they've made those connections in order to be able to grow. So it's like, that's kind of like my felt sense of where we need to move with how we conceive of movements.
I guess I'm thinking of movements with, you know, large numbers of people and organization and all that stuff. But what I'm hearing from you is that, you know, just start within yourself.
Well, it's kind of both at the same time and figuring out, because like you can wrap it up in a movement and put all of your energy into trying to change things. For example, like academia. Academia is not designed to be changed from the inside. It's designed to change you once you're inside it. So there is this kind of like delusion that people have that the labels that are superficially applied to the superstructures we all exist inside of are accurate, but they're completely diametrically opposed to what's been like suggested to us. And to give you a good example, continuing with education. So like John Taylor Gatto, he'll give the example that the best teachers are actually the biggest problem because their emotional energy is what allows the depravity of that system to continue. And so it's one of those things where it's like, you can see extraordinary, wonderful people putting genuine care and actually doing things for the better, but they're trapped in the belly of the beast at the exact same time. And so that's one of those really excruciatingly painful things because of how long we've been lied to and how many of these labels have been put on things to like lead us astray, where it's like, yeah, we need to start with ourselves. We also need to expose these organizations for what we are. I think as these organizations continue to deteriorate and become more dictatorial, those really good people inside of them will increasingly migrate and just leave and say, be like, okay, I've had it. I'm done with this. You know, like what's happened to medicine, what's happened to all these various different institutions. These are predatory, parasitic, and they're designed to hurt people, not to help them. And then look at the FBI. It's like, it's Terror Inc. It's designed to make terrorists happen. It's not there to keep you safe. It's like, so it's accurately labeling things and recognizing what your strengths are. That's sort of where we're at right now. Those are the two things that we need to do most.
You're a very intelligent man. You have a bookshelf behind you filled with books that seem like they have lots of dog ears, and they actually look, unlike my bookshelf, like they've all been read. What do you think are some really good intro level, if you wanted to call them conspiracy books, but books that you could give to somebody that make a difference? When we first started, I mean, I've heard people say retarded things like Behold a Pale Horse is a good conspiracy 101 book. And I'm like, I couldn't be further from the truth. It's like, oh yeah, read Bloodlines of the Illuminati, you know, that'll teach you. I gave Deborah John Perkins' book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman first. I think that's a great entry level book.
Yeah. No, that was one of the ones that kind of sprung to my mind because back when I read it, like the problem is that there's a divide between what people are willing to recognize as corruption in the world and the degree to which people are willing to acknowledge that it's actually a deliberate commodity. So corruption is not something that happens by accident. it's something that happens by design. The machine is not broken. It's working perfectly to do what it's supposed to do, which is keep people poor in order to make them more efficient slaves.
Yeah.
So like there's a, it's almost, it's like, it's not impossible, but it's very difficult people to go from their understanding that corruption is bad and that it's real to, oh no, this is actually something that is being done by a certain class of psychopaths using think tanks and working groups in order to ensure that things stay that way forever. I also thought of, you know, Charlie's works. You go into like the Controlled Demolition of the American Empire or Octopus of Global Control. But even then, it's like it's pushing the threshold of people's ability to be able to grasp that. I think of like some of the introductory books that I had. And once again, your John Perkins book was a good one. I think like No Logo by Naomi Klein really helped me understand how broken like sweatshop labor and advertising, all that stuff was. But even then, she ends up working for the World Economic Forum. So it's like she herself doesn't have that full spectrum awareness. And John Perkins, he's pro-vaccine. And you can look at like Jesse Ventura, he's very pro-vaccine. So it's like, yeah, you get all these weird mixes of, it's like people get this side of it. There's this whole other side. And it's like, I don't think people are really going to be able to reach that point of understanding the commodification of poverty and disaster capitalism until like, I'd say basically shit hits the fan and things start to get worse and they themselves start to experience. Because if you talk to poor people in an impoverished country, they understand that that's how things are built by design. You talk to people here, it's like they're on the receiving end of the cheaper goods. It's we don't understand this. So it's like, I wish that there were, that's kind of like the thing you're describing is almost like what I'm designing my show to do. So as far as books you can give people, I don't know. Because it's like, even then, it's like only 25% or something of Americans have read a book in the last year. So it's like, it's a dying medium at the same time. So it's like, and you can look at the emergence of the Russian Revolution. It was a highly illiterate population. The way in which they were able to get people to become more energized was through filmmaking, which was just then starting to emerge. So it's like, where we're at right now, I actually think it's more like a show that would be encouraging to show people. That's kind of like, I'm not trying to like toot my own horn here, but it's like this, that thing that you're describing is what I'm gonna do. I'm trying to crack that egg, man. It's hard.
Yeah, when you say 25%, it sounds shocking at first, and then now I think about it and I think that's probably a very, very generously high percentage. I think it's much less than that. I'd say 10%.
Yeah.
And so kind of what you're describing,
it's definitely higher. I mean, no, I like that. if instead of just,
I'm frozen. That'd be awesome. My back?
You're back.
Okay. So sorry. What I was, if someone reads Confessions of an Economic Hitman, what they're not going to glean from that text is that it's not just about money. It's not just the old term, follow the money. That's not good enough. Like, it's designed to make slaves. There's more to it than just enriching people. I think that the best way to see that is, you know, Bill, like, just to think about, why does Bill Gates need more money? He doesn't, you know, there's gotta be something else. Maybe that 4-part James Corbett, Bill Gates documentary. That's a good one to watch too.
Yeah, what's it called? Go ahead.
What's the name of the Bill Gates, Clinton documentary?
No, Bill Gates.
Meet Bill Gates.
We're talking. No, about the one that Adam just mentioned. It's what?
Did we lose Adam?
Am I frozen? I'm sorry.
Yeah, guys. I think you're in and out there, Adam.
Yeah. Can you? I'm talking about the. Tell Deborah about the 4-part James Corbett series about Bill Gates.
Okay. All right. Got it.
That's the thing though, it's like we can think of all of these different things that we think might work for someone else, but it's like it could end up being the fluoride in the water, you know. It's like, no, it's the same thing that they made people dumber with in the gulag, and it's doing the same thing to us here. And it's like, it also accumulates in your bones, and it's actually racist. It disproportionately accumulates in the African-American population. So it's like, tap water is racist. Maybe that will be the thing that's able to get liberals to listen to you or something, you know. But it's like, I don't know, man. It's not a point that you reach. It's a labyrinth you almost like bump around through with the hope that you're going to come out the other end and actually be successful in making that connection. So, I wish I had the answer. I wish I did.
Yeah. I think the place to start is just getting your own house in order. And, you know, if you're doing the right thing and living a good life in these times, I think, attraction rather than promotion and just having what people want is what'll attract people to you and allow you to wake people up. And it'll also the right people that you want around you most of the time, hopefully will be the ones that you're able to interact with and have in your community. So that's what I think.
Yeah. It's so complex at the same time, because it's like, we're seeing weaponized everything, everything. And so it's like, the real epidemic is drug addiction. And man, like the homelessness problem and all these different things that are disaster capitalism 101.
What do you think? Mm-hmm. Do you think like, you put SSRIs in there as well?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. it's a lot of different layers to it. And like, I was like, just understand, like the allopathic model is psychopathic and like keeping all these various different alternatives from people is a gross distortion of the oath they themselves swear in order to practice. So it's psychopathic and hypocritical. Now I have to qualify that at the exact same time that there is a portion of the allopathic model that is extraordinarily important and invaluable. And we cannot and should not lose, which is that it's very good for like traumatic injuries and things like that. There are certain things where you want that system around, but at the same time, it's like, you can look at the diminishing effects of psilocybin on people's depression. And that isn't something that facilitates drug addiction. It's something that helps people remove themselves from it. So it's very much a sequence of things that are built on top of one another to compound. A visual representation for that I like to use is that of a Jenga, which is that if you look at it from above it, it looks like it's just a square. But if you rotate it, it's actually all of these rectangles that are built on top of one another in order to appear like that singular column. That's called stacking functions. And so, yeah, SSRIs and like this whole thing, it's like they overlap and they create other problems, which then overlap and create other problems. And it's just that whole system that we need to increasingly recognize for what it is and simply remove ourselves from. So that's bringing it back to what you were saying with that it is about getting your house in order in those communities and finding that strength to be able to lead by example. Yeah.
Right on. What about, so we've heard, you know, the Klaus Schwab World Economic Forum talk about subscription-based cities, you'll own nothing and be happy. And then in that same document, they also say there's a group of people who live outside of the cities, and they had a very different life. Do you see, I mean, I think we're already in a big societal split. Do you see any hope for people who just say, I don't want anything to do with living in a subscription-based city? Maybe I'll go try to do my own thing and create community outside. Do you think that there's any hope in that?
Yeah, absolutely. My personal thing that I'm working for with what I'm doing and what I'm trying to get other people to let's say come to appreciate the notion of themselves is, if we wake everyone up, we don't have to go through this hell. The more in which you're able to get other people to understand the situation that they're in a non-aggressive, forceful, or abusive manner where you're just disrespecting their kind of space and stuff, but at the same time, you're making it very clear that this actually is important. If we wake everyone up, it's like, we're gonna see things that are difficult for us to conceive of as possible. Akin to how much devastation we've seen in the past few years, we can see that kind of revitalized, the revolution, you know, that's what we want to see. So it's like these doomsday prophecies that they have written into existence, that they then tell us about how they're going to abuse us, because that's one of the methods of torturing someone. You show them the thing that you're going to torture them with so that they know what's coming, and then that amps them up so that they suffer more. And so it's like, No, screw all of that. We're just going to wake everyone up. We're going to change the conversation. We're going to evolve the culture. We're going to be those people who are smarter, who are telling the truth, who have what other people want. And that is going to be the thing that inspires hope across the world, because those communities of people, that's what everyone wants. Whether we realize it or not, or we recognize it or not, it's like, if you're in a city, you're feeling lonely most of the time, you know? And if you're able to get a blip of existing outside of those confinement, it's like, it gives you purpose and life again. So if we're able to let people know that the purpose of their life is the truth, not just their subjective interpretation of it, but how we all share in it, then that's something that facilitates an emergence of a future that the elites will never write about because they don't want us to think about, you know?
Got it.
I'm reading a note here. I can't.
Hey, do you, we've had you for a while, Tease. Do you guys, Chud or Deborah, have any questions or thoughts?
Just try to live a good, clean life and influence people.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is like everything you're saying is really great about, you know, getting together with other people and being able to cross the aisle and you know, bridge these gaps and all these things. And it just kind of, it's not really related, but at the same time, it's something I've been talking about a lot on a few different podcasts lately, that like within the conspiracy world that I'm so involved. You know, like I see it all the time, just within the world, there's things like you have like flat earthers and alien believers who cannot be in the same room as each other because they can't get along. But I'm like really trying to point out more and more these days that, like, you know, yeah, but what do you guys agree on? You guys both like believe that NASA is full of shit, for instance, you know, like you have so much common ground. And then within that, you probably have similar thoughts about COVID and the pandemic and the economy. And, you know, like there's probably, you know, like earlier I was saying, instead of one thing, try and find people with 10. Well, the flat earther and the alien believer, they might have like 50 things that they agree on, but then there ends up being just one thing and it wipes everything else off. And I feel like, you know, we just need to be a little more open-minded when it comes to talking to other people. You know, if there's one thing that doesn't work, then let it go. But at the same time, I'm going to contradict what I just said. And then if there's something that you're passionate enough about, you can't necessarily fold on that. But then, yeah, you know, that's exactly the opposite of what I'm telling flat earther versus alien guy, you know, like you guys should get over that. Well, that's obviously their most important thing if they're willing to throw all of the other points out.
Well, I think that's a great insight. So the premise of infighting and how it keeps us what it is to be awake, you know, and it's like, well, what is that? From a flat earther's perspective, you'd have to agree with them in order to be awake. And so that's why I try and use the premise of our central focus upon what is actually most imperative to all of us, which is twofold: freedom and morality. That's it. The rest of it is more to do with belief. And so here's the analogy that I use to talk to flat earthers. It's okay, so we have a ritualistic blood sacrifice of offering infants to Baal, you know, basically just rich, like murdering countless people. What shape is the table that they're being murdered on? That's what's really important here, you know? So it's like, once we recalibrate the conversation to, oh, right, it actually doesn't matter the shape of the table. It matters if other people are being horrifically immoral, then we're able to recalibrate based on what the bedrock of all of society is, right, which is freedom, morality, and our ability to simply be people. Then we can talk about our beliefs. But if we put our beliefs before the floor, then we're never going to be able to build anything off of it. We're just going to keep going into that quicksand over and over again.
Dude, you just nailed it. That was really, really well done. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we should put a pin in it right there and call it for the day, unless you guys have anything else you want to talk about.
That's good. It's tough.
Tease, you killed it. How can we support you?
Best thing to do is to actively use my show, which is designed to be an outreach tool. to try and maybe sit down with some friends and family who might be becoming a little bit more receptive to these ideas. Because I remember like a year ago, Deborah watched the first episode and she's just like, you said it in a way that was just like a lot more simple and straightforward. And it's just like, yeah. So that's why I'm trying to take the things that I'm best at as an artist to just be like, okay, here's the stuff that you guys want. If you don't feel like you can say it in this way, if you don't feel like you have the knowledge base, a lot of people have done that legwork already. So the best way to support me is to use the tools that I've created to support you. Try and use it to reach out to your friends and family to be able to get them in the know about some of the basics so that we can all go out there and help each other out. And so my show is Conspiracy Synergy. It's at conspiracysynergy.com. It's on, you know, Rockfin, Rumble, BitChute, Odyssey, Internet Archive, not YouTube. And the best thing to do is just check that out and share it with the people you know and love.
Sounds fantastic. Awesome, man.
Cool. Yeah, we'll link everything in the show notes. And yeah, guys, check it all out and share it with everybody you know that'll be receptive. And use it as like a litmus tool, you know, like that's another good thing as well. So we really appreciate it, Tees. And let's hit us up when you get your next episode coming out, or if you want to talk to anything about anything before like that.
3-4 months.
Okay, cool, man.
I'll let you go. It's designed to address a lot of the stuff that we're talking about in this conversation. It's like you just give people the visuals and they're like, oh yeah, no, that makes perfect. It's actually really easy. Otherwise they're like bang stuff together and it's like, dude, it's the other way around. And they're like, oh, okay. And then they have a nice chair they can sit in. That's all we got to do. That it's really that simple. And then just be kind to each other and try and forgive the people who are assholes about the whole thing. So yeah.
Right on, man.
But I'll touch base.
Well, thanks for this conversation. It's been a great talk. It's good to meet you.
Yeah.
You too. Thanks, guys.
All right. Thanks, guys. See ya. Peace out. Don't eat too much poutine. Bye-bye.
See ya.
I'm not doing this for you. I'm doing this for me. I'm not signed on to killing all those old people or those black babies. Fuck you, motherfucking New World Order. I will get your ass to lay that. It pisses me off. You sign on to playing God, you get burned. And all you dumbasses that serve the New World Order, idiots. Playing God all day. Deciding who lives and who dies.
Penis man.
And then I find out they're all screwing little kids and devil worshiping. Of course they are. Oh, you're the big elites. Oprah Winfrey and Ted Turner and Bill Clinton and Epstein, all in that 7-story pervert building in New York. What a bunch of freaks. And the fact that those pedophiles, and I'm calling Oprah Winfrey one, hope she burns in hell. Every damn one of you's a piece of crap. And you're gonna be judged. So you just continue to enjoy hurting babies and hurting old people and hurting homeless people and turn us all into a bunch of idiots. Because you will be destroyed.
Mom, I'm transgender.